Welcome to the Plant Cunning Podcast,
where we explore our relationship to plants, other people, and the mysteries of nature.
Coming to you from the High Allegheny Plateau in central New York,
we are your hosts, A.C. Staubel
and Isaac Hill.
Today on the Plant Cunning Podcast, we are thrilled to have Taryn Forelli, the Chief Science Officer and Naturopathic Doctor at Traditional Medicinals. Hi, Taryn. How are you?
I am so well. It is wonderful to see both of your faces.
Yeah. It's so good to see you too. So we actually got to meet Taryn in real life. We met at the Hawthorne Plant Initiation at Pam Montgomery's beautiful farm and homestead in Vermont. And it was just a week after the Traditional Medicinals publicist had hit us up and said, hey, do you want to interview Taryn from Traditional Medicinals? And we were like, normally we don't really listen to these publicist emails. We're just like, maybe. But we were like, yeah, we do actually want to interview Taryn from Traditional Medicinals. And then we met you in person and we're like, wait, is that the person?
I know, that was pretty cool. I hadn't realized that she had reached out and... Yeah. You know, there we find ourselves in, you know, this beautiful sanctuary of plants. And then that connection with Hawthorne was just amazing. So, yeah, I couldn't be happier than I am right now to see you both and know that we both still have the Hawthorne connection going and here to talk about more plants and the great work that Traditional Medicinals does as well.
Yeah, it's so awesome. So we do have a traditional first question to get us going on the podcast, and it's, how did you come to the plant path?
You know, I often reflect on that, and because I think it's like a path that is always there that most people, if they spend some time reflecting on it, will say, yeah, I've been on the plant path too. But it often starts in childhood, right? And some of my fondest memories are from playing in this giant field, you know, this meadow that was down at the base of the neighborhood I lived in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Wasn't anything like exotic by any means, but it was a wonderland. You know, it was like a dream space of like, you just go into it and all of a sudden like imagination was opened up. You know, it was obviously a lot of imaginative play, but also adventure. You know, I remember just going out by myself and climbing up these giant hills. And there was also a little bit of like challenge and mystery in there. In fact, I was remembering recently, there was the road alongside the field was called Sleepy Hollow Road. Wow. And it would lead to, you weren't quite sure. It was like the home for bad kids back there. Uh-huh. And so Mysterious. It was like, yeah, it had everything in it. And so that's kind of like, again, when I think of like my Hawthorne heart coming alive, it's like in that space, that like container. Nice. So as I moved along, you know, growing up, I loved science as well. And it was something I always excelled in. And of course, you know, my mother planted the seed, well, you should be a doctor, you know? And in fact, I did. I thought the human body was like fascinating. And so I went off to college to study biology in pre-med. And as I was doing that program, a couple things happened. First of all, you know, you're out on your own in the world, and I start being exposed to more interesting people and other ways of thinking about life. I also remember taking a plant physiology course where, you know, we started talking about how plants make things like melatonin and serotonin. And it's like, you know, and then I'm taking my human physiology class and, you know, kind of making the connection between, wow, there's a lot of interrelatedness and even the chemistries and like, well, what does that mean then when we put these plants in our body? And, you know, really, you know, the thing that I think a lot about is how plants kind of change the lens in which we can see the world through their chemistries.
Yeah.
I think that's fascinating. So sure enough, you know, I started stepping into what would, you know, learning about naturopathy as an alternative to conventional medicine. And I went off and pursued that degree post graduation. And that was amazing, you know, being amongst naturopaths for 4 years for the students and all the things you get exposed to, both plant medicine or herbalism, but all these other modalities as well, nutrition and acupuncture, physical manipulation, and it was all fascinating. It's all just like, it's become like a philosophy for me in my life of how to navigate the world and interpret kind of our place in nature. So I love naturopathic medicine. But as I came out of that program, again, it was always the plants that I was most fond of. And I did practice for a short amount of time, but then for me, it was always about like formulating. I loved this idea of like making, you know, formulations for people. You know, just everyone that came in would get their own custom formula.
Yeah.
And then, maybe just a year into my career, I was like, maybe there's another way to use all this kind of information I have and, you know, passion for the plants. And I found a place for myself in the natural products industry. I actually, you know, had approached the company New Chapter that was up in Vermont. I was living in Connecticut at the time and asked if they needed a naturopath. And lo and behold, there was an opportunity to kind of start a practitioner program there. And that kind of began my journey in the natural products industry. And I've been working for 20 years now doing R&D and innovation and education, all of which has led me to this opportunity to be at Traditional Medicinals.
Okay, cool. Sweet. Yeah. Didn't know you grew up in Pittsburgh. That's cool.
Yeah, I grew up
a little bit.
For a little while. Okay, yeah. I think it's from there. That's why you were like, oh, Pittsburgh.
Yeah, it's interesting. I moved to the Boston or East Coast area when I was 12, and then I kind of consider my formative years out there. But yeah, the Pittsburgh roots, you know, why not?
Yeah,
those hills are definitely mysterious and magical.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, awesome.
Yeah, that's so cool. So what is the chief science officer do? That's your role at Traditional Medicinal. Mm-hmm. So what does that look like on the day-to-day?
Well, it's a role that I have to say I'm very honored to have, because I get to work amongst many, many experts in the field of herbal medicine. But I oversee our quality, our research and development, and then our innovation department. So it's about 40 a team of about 40 experts, I would say. We have herbalists, naturopaths, ethnobotanists, chemists, food scientists, of course, microbiologists. We have a botanist that's one of the kind of premier authorities on botanical identification. Yeah, just so many interesting people that I get to work with. And I kind of lead those teams in kind of doing all the good work, and I get to, tap in on a daily basis to, there's always a lot of activity happening at Traditional Medicinal. So, yeah.
Sweet. And how is Traditional Medicinals different than other wellness companies, in your opinion, just from being in the industry for so long?
Yeah. Well, you know, I think that, first of all, Traditional Medicinals is almost 50 years old. So this is what you call a true legacy brand. So in terms of like street cred and kind of walking the walk for a long time, there's not many other companies that have been doing it as long as Traditional Medicinals. And from the start, the company has made a very strong commitment to a few things. You know, Rosemary Gladstar was one of the founders with Drake Sadler, who was her partner at the time. And they had like both, you know, very strong interests in a couple of very complementary things. So for Rosemary, it was very much about herbal education. Mm-hmm. She wanted to, you know, put products out in the world that could bring people into herbalism. It was a vehicle for educating them about the power of plants. Drake was kind of a environmentalist and very much a social activist. And for him, it was about bringing kind of using herbalism to help do good in the world. And that meant going back to where the plants come from and making sure that the livelihoods of those growers, those producers, they were being taken care of, that the land's being taken care of. So everything that we do starts with, where does the plants come from? I'd say another layer in there is the quality standard, which I think is just, you know, as high as it can be within the industry. Obviously, we're labeled as a dietary supplement brand. Most of your teas are not. They're just beverage teas, right? So that makes a real difference in how you source herbs. So that kind of commitment to quality, to social good and environmental activism, and then, you know, education, that all makes traditional medicinals a very special company. And coming into it, you know, I remember way back in the early days of naturopathic school, I was told by some of my teachers that, you know, if you really wanted to use kind of a commercially available herbal tea product for your patients to recommend, then you wanted to use traditional medicinals because they really put the, you know, the efficacy in it. They make sure the efficacy is there. So I held that with me, you know, again, all through my career. And that was one of the reasons why I was so, you know, drawn to the company is because of their reputation for quality. But when I got there, and I've been at traditional medicinals for almost 2 years now, in December it'll be 2 years, I realized just how much deeper that commitment and that kind of specialness really, really went in terms of, again, the sourcing and, you know, really the purpose of TM is to inspire active connection to plant wisdom in service of people and the planet. Oh. And it's like, of course, that's what I want to be doing. And yeah. It shows, and we do that by basically signing up voluntarily for certification. Certainly organic is one way, but we also are very committed to Fair for Life. So we've made a commitment by 2030 to have at least 80% of our herbs be Fair for Life certified. And that's this whole, I mean, maybe we can talk another time about that, but it's basically this whole program by which you make sure that everyone involved, all of the stakeholders from the growers to the producers to even, you know, the customer, which in this case is TM, is signed up to making sure that, you know, there's social responsibility, economic responsibility, and then environmental. So like everything is being taken care of. And that's how we make sure that these plants are available for us for years and years to come. So.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Very cool. Yeah. That's kind of rare that you like, sometimes the more you know about a company, you think they like portray themselves in a certain way, but the more, you know, you become disappointed. But that's really good to hear that you've worked for them for 2 years and you're like, yeah, this is kind of the gold standard.
Yeah. Yeah. There's more, there's always so much more. And, you know, I often compare it to like, it's like the Patagonia of, kind of the herbal world or the kind of supplement world, where that whole idea of like, where do things come from, taking care of the people, being very kind of conscious in how we do business.
Right.
Yeah.
So how does that happen? In the practicality, like how do you source the herbs and make sure that they're good quality? Like,
Well, it starts by forming relationships with the people that are doing the work. And again, I have not had the opportunity in my career to ever work with a company that has boots on the ground at the sites where the herbs are coming from. And again, most companies don't even know where their herbs come from. They're buying on a kind of a commodity level. So from the beginning, I mean, we are fortunate to have Joseph Brinkman on our staff, who is probably one of the like world's kind of authorities on sustainable supply chains. And he's been with TM off and on for a lot of our history. I don't know the exact year number, but he got involved back in the 70s and has been going along for the ride. But yeah, it starts with kind of going there and talking to the farmers and training them. We invest a lot in programs that help up-level their knowledge. We want to preserve the knowledge that they already have. And this is especially true with wildcrafting, right? It's an art of knowing how to properly identify and collect the herbs in a way that, you know, doesn't, you know, you don't over harvest,
totally.
You don't you know, contaminate the collection with other weeds.
Right.
So all that stuff, we invest in the training and forming the relationship so that we can have the transparency. And we can, you know, when, if something does not meet our standards, then we can go back and have a conversation to say, well, you know, we really like your chamomile, but we need to make sure that it always meets our standard for potency, or, and there may be ways to adjust either the processing or the harvesting, or, you know, how it's being grown to get to that standard. So yeah, kind of working very closely with our partners is where the quality starts.
Yeah, that seems very important, actually, having relationships with the farmers and the people growing and wild harvesting their herbs. Because as you say, a lot of herbalists, like community herbalists, don't even know where the herbs are actually coming from if they're buying from a large mm-hmm. company. And those companies might not even. And that's one of the great things about being like a self-sufficient herbalist or growing and harvesting your own herbs, because you know exactly what. Exactly. What is in the product, what is in the medicine that you're using and giving out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's such an important thing. I think, you know, what we're doing is bringing herbs to the masses, right? And so to do that, it has to be, well, starting with the expertise. And that's why we have all these herbalists and naturopaths on staffs, because it's like, well, let's make sure we formulate with the right herbs and, you know, it's going to deliver the efficacy. But then when it comes time to go gather the herbs and collect them, whereas, you know, kind of an herbalist that's working on their own, again, they rely on their expertise. The consumer is putting their trust in the company now to source the right herb. And believe it or not, just basic identification is a really, really important piece of the puzzle here. But like, for instance, in chamomile, we formulate using the kind of pharmacopoeia as the standard of quality. And that tells us, the pharmacopoeia is basically a textbook, usually government issued, that tells you what quality tests you need to do on a medicinal ingredient if you want it to be used, again, for therapeutic purposes. And so in the case of chamomile, it says that only the flowering top should be used, because that's where all the chemistries, that's where the essential oils are, that's where apigenin is in the petals, which, you know, performs a lot of the key functions of that plant. Mm-hmm. So for us, we specify that we will only take the flowering top. Whereas if you're just, you know, sourcing food grade chamomile, which again, most of your beverages or, you know, non-medicinal teas most commonly do, they would use the whole top, the whole aerial parts, right?
Stem and leaves.
Yeah, right. And so that's, you know, it may taste fine. It tastes different than pharmacopoeia grade. And it's certainly safe, but it dilutes it, right? So you're not getting that same kind of potency and efficacy ultimately that the consumer most likely wants when they're drinking their chamomile tea.
A lot of filler.
Yeah, yeah. So yeah, this idea of kind of bringing herbalism to the masses requires that we set these standards that ensures consistency, efficacy, obviously, and then reliability. Like, we want consumers to have that same experience every time they consume one of our products, because they're oftentimes relying on it for an intended health benefit. But yeah, it's a little different model, but I think that whole idea of kind of expertise as you formulate and put product out into the world applies whether you're a lay herbalist or someone who's growing for yourself or bringing it to the masses.
Yeah, and that's really good to hear. It's also because when you're buying something from a store and you see a powder, you have no idea actually what's in it. Mm. And there are a lot of stories of less than reputable companies mixing in herbs that aren't even part of it, let alone the stems and filler. So from your work in the dietary industry, supplement industry for so long, how do you advise people to be able to trust what is actually in the products that they're buying instead of just
yeah.
Because yeah. How do you know?
That's a tough one sometimes, right? Because I have a lot of people that will ask me, what about this brand? Do you know this brand? You know, is this good? And I often only kind of endorse the brands that I know have, again, the expertise behind them, both from, you know, like, well, who formulated the product? Because a lot of products, quite honestly, are made as white label products, where it's like, you don't even, it's like a manufacturer offers a range of formulas that have been created just to, well, you know, to make it easily, someone could put their label on it and put it out into the market. Right.
So that's a white label product is, well, could you, for people who don't know what a white label product is, could you explain it quickly?
Yeah. And again, I'm not saying that white label products are bad. I'm just saying that you don't always know who formulated them. Right. And so I think for me, the question is like, who formulated the product? And the best products come from brands where they have scientists, formulators, experts on staff that understand the efficacy, the safety, you know, again, the sustainability, to know where those products come from, how they're going to work, you know, kind of with each other. Like, do these herbs mix well together? Are there any kind of watch outs in terms of other things that you might be taking? Do they have the right kind of warnings on them? What kind of dosing are they kind of recommending? All of that plays into, I mean, when I look at a label, I can often see that there's a lot of what I call pixie dusting happening, where you put an ingredient in there just so it can be on the label, but it's in an insignificant amount. And we see this a lot with, unfortunately, mushrooms these days, right? Yeah, because in many cases, you need quite a bit. You need quite a bit, unless it's an extract, you can often get away with a little less, but you know, so you see, is it a whole herb? Is it powder or is it an extract? And, you know, an extract obviously is more concentrated, but I'm often blown away by how often I see things that clearly don't have efficacious dose levels in them.
Yeah.
And it's hard. It is hard for the consumer. So again, it goes back to who's behind the brand, what kind of commitments have they made to quality, efficacy, and sustainability. And yeah, and then often, you know, what kind of claims are they making? Can they stand behind those claims? And don't be afraid to like engage with the company if you want or you need to kind of get those questions answered.
Yeah, that's a good point. You can always like reach out and engage to the company and see where they're actually sourcing them. Cause even like you might think, well, I'm getting my herbs from my local herbalist, but they might be also getting their herbs from a big box store, you know, like type of herbal company where they have already been sitting on the shelf for many months before they come to your herbalist, and then they go and sit on your shelf before you end up taking them all. And yeah, so it's good.
It's tricky. And I think oh, go ahead. Sorry.
No, that's it. Just finding out and asking questions to the source, you know, and getting to the root source, I think is really important these days.
Yeah. I was going to add that you can also ask about certifications. So certifications are how brands can be held accountable. So I mentioned, you know, organic certification, traditional medicinals was a very early participant in the National Organic Program, the first herbal tea company to become organic. Yeah. And so that's one way, again, that's one level of a quality standard that you may think about, because it's like, well, if you're taking herbs for a health benefit, probably the last thing you want is a little infusion of pesticides in your tea as well, right?
Totally.
Right.
We want to put the goodness in our bodies. Yeah. So organic, I mean, there's also what we call GMP certification. So good manufacturing practices. There's a kind of misconception, a common misconception that the dietary supplement industry is not regulated. In fact, the FDA does regulate dietary supplements and requires that you follow good manufacturing practices. And so you can actually kind of hold yourself accountable to a third party certification of that as well. So again, these kind of certifications, the Fair for Life that I mentioned earlier, that traditional medicinals is committed to non-GMO, those are ways that you know that companies are showing up in a way that proves that they are committed to quality and, you know, doing well in the world.
Totally.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sweet. Are there any other like aspects of good quality herbs that you look for, you know, like a quality control person? Like,
yeah,
the sourcing, the type, the parts of the plants that you mentioned, like the chamomile flower versus the stems and leaves, like what other aspects of quality are important?
Sensory. The sensory evaluation, which is a lot of fun. Yeah. So every lot of herb that we have come in the door goes up to our lab and gets tasted. So it's an evaluation of how does it look? How does it smell? How does it taste? Mm-hmm. And that tells you a lot about the quality of the herb. And in fact, as a consumer, I encourage people to engage their senses, right? When they are tasting, or if they're having tea is such a beautiful ritual because it's like a mindful moment, right? The time that it takes to boil the water, to brew the tea, like you're slowing down. And if you also take a moment to inhale or inspire the aroma of the plant or the infusion before you taste it, you start to like notice some of the chemistries that are coming out, right? And that in itself can tell you about the plant, how much it might be delivering. And then you taste it, and that also kind of awakens kind of these signals in our body that say, oh, well, this peppermint is so, you know, it's opening up my passageways. I feel, you know, kind of stimulated or awake by it. Like those sensations are also like our own way of having quality indicators. But yeah, in our lab and in the way that we evaluate the herbs, we have, you know, a set of kind of standards that they must meet in terms of those organoleptic characteristics.
Mm-hmm. I love that word.
I love it too. I just had to throw it in because I knew you all would appreciate it.
Thank you. Yes, the organoleptics, the smell, taste, feel, look. It's like I think I like it because it's like giving a human the authority to know the quality and to identify the herb rather than depending on like just the chemical constituents in a lab and how it comes back in testing. Because like, you know the difference of a peppermint that is like freshly dried and, you know, smells really strong and tastes really strong and maybe even makes your eyes water, you know,
versus
that's like 6 years old and brown and barely has a smell when you crunch it, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. I mean, these things are kind of programmed into us through our, you know, ancestral relationships with plants. Yeah. And so
it's empowering to me.
Yeah.
Yeah. It feels good. It feels good to have that, you know, internal authority.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then as you become more familiar with, again, what smells good, what tastes good, and then ultimately what feels good in your body, that just allows you to kind of deepen your connection to nature, I think. I mean, this whole idea of, again, taking that moment to drop into what you feel, what you taste, what you sense, reminds us of kind of that experience of being in nature. So that's why I love that as well.
Totally. Yeah.
I like to bring up the example of calendula. Like we grow calendula for the salves that she makes. And there's just such a difference in the bright orange vibrancy. And you can feel like it's just more potent. You know, feels more potent. And you can see like a year old calendula, it's just, it does not quite as potent. It's not quite as you know, charged, bright. Yeah. And then the stuff that you can get from big herb companies is just brown and nothing
oxidized.
There.
Oxidized. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So it does seem like a lot of dried herbs don't have that long of a shelf life to begin with. And it's a little bit easier in a way for small herbalists who are giving the herbs directly to the people they're working with. because in a big company, I'm sure there's a lot of like, you know, gotta have to ship it across the world and then has to go through all these, might be in a storage for how, I don't know how long, but like, how do you make sure that that aspect of the herbs retaining their potency happens with that kind of large scale situation?
Yeah. So assuming you've kind of harvested, you know, with care, processed with care, and you have like a very good starting product, which, you know, let's say that's the starting point.
Right.
You know, the enemy of herbs is basically exposure to air, oxygen, and humidity. Light, but most of them are packaged in kind of in dark light blocking material. But you can actually preserve the potency of herbs for quite a while if they are stored properly. So again, this is where knowledge and expertise comes into play. Now, what we do, again, because we have to deliver a product that is going to sit on the shelf or maybe in a warehouse for a while, and our shelf life is up to 3 years, right, on many of our products. And the way that we do that is by, you know, wrapping the tea bags individually in these kind of very kind of air resistant barriers, the overwraps, we call them. Not all tea products that are commercially available are wrapped in these individual packets, but that's kind of the little, let's preservation package, so to speak, that allows that product to stay fresh throughout its shelf life. When you're dealing with bulk herbs that might not be, again, kind of carefully controlled in terms of how they're stored, then yeah, you're going to get a lot of loss of potency. And that's unfortunate, both in terms of efficacy as well as that experience that you were talking about earlier. And if you're going to make a claim like we do on, hey, this is good for however many months or years, you have to actually perform stability tests that track kind of those markers of efficacy as well as those sensory characteristics to make sure that, yep, that still is going to deliver that same experience that we intend at the end of the shelf life. So that's one way to do it, right? That's how we ensure, at least at traditional medicinals, that you can still have a fresh product.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So the other thing about, I think that those are very helpful for especially big companies, but it can be a little bit more difficult for like small herbalists to navigate their hoops for.
Yeah.
That don't necessarily have the resources to jump through. I see them as very important for bigger companies because, with a smaller herbalist, you also have the more one-on-one connection, and you can see, people can come and see AC, you know, the AC's calendula, for instance, and people can tell when they have the salve, it's like, you know, it's got the juice, but it's a little more, it can be more difficult. So how do you see that for the smaller herbalists? I don't know. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, I think smaller herbalists tend to not produce as big of batches, right? So
yeah. And they don't have to sit on the shelf as long either.
Usually. Yeah. So that's a really important distinction is you're usually formulating for what you need for your own, who you're going to touch, right? Your clients or your customers. And I'm sure AC, after doing your work for as long as you have a sense of how much you need. And that's always like an important piece of being an herbalist is harvesting what you need or purchasing what you need, because these are such precious resources, right? We don't want to, we don't want to waste them. We don't want them to end up in the compost pile. So I think it's that mindfulness around respecting that this is a something that should be taken care of. But I think, even proper storage, you know, knowing that herbs that are stored properly are going to last a lot longer. And of course, once you transform it, it depends on like the format or the delivery medium, so to speak. In something like a salve, you're kind of like preserving the herb already. Like that is a way to preserve it. Tinctures last basically forever.
Totally.
So I think it's just more, maybe we're just talking about like the dried herbs as well. you know, you want to make extracts too, but yeah, powdered extracts.
Well, I'm also talking about, so for the bigger companies, these, the compliances and things are very helpful for making sure that they have, there's accountability. But for smaller herbalists, it's hoops, regulatory hoops that they have to jump through that make it harder to do what they need to do.
I know. It is challenging, right? Where it's the testing can be cost prohibitive.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. I hear that a lot.
Just recognizing there's different scales too. Yeah.
Absolutely. It's a challenging system, you know, where it's meant to obviously protect the consumer, the end user. But I think it's important not to limit the work of people that are doing, you know, the good work in the world. So there can be, I think, challenges on both ends in terms of compliance.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
So with those tea bags that y'all are making, they just like pack so much punch. Like I need to use like a whole like handful of herbs to make my like, you know, pot of tea that's as strong as one of the tea bags from TM. Are you using like extracts in your tea, or like are you just like powdering them down, like, or you know, getting them down fine enough that there's enough surface area that when it drops into the water it really like fills it up? Like how do you do that?
It's a little of both. So we do use what's called tea bag cut herbs, which does, you know, put them into a smaller particle size so that they will diffuse more easily through the tea bag. Often when we're working with our just dried herbs that have been harvested or purchased in bulk, it's like fluffier, right? It's there's more bulk to that. So yeah, it does get shrunk down, but also, you know, not every herb is appropriate for a tea bag. We can't fit more than 2 grams in a tea bag. And usually a little less than that is ideal. So there's this really fun challenge of figuring out how much can fit in the tea bag and deliver efficacy. And again, that's where we go back to the monographs that have been published that tell us, you know, again, how much of this herb is required for the efficacy of it. And we make sure that we deliver those. Now you can get into herbs that just don't diffuse in water on their own. And of course, you know, herbalists, you know that some herbs need to be decocted or, you know, it's just going to take longer. And well, we're telling people to brew this for 10 to 15 minutes at the most. So in those cases, if we want to use herbs that don't diffuse easily in water, then we will make an extract of it, either a water or hydroethanolic extract, and then powder it. And then that gets mixed in with the other tea bag cut herbs. And then sometimes you'll have a combination of extracts and then those tea bag cut herbs. And that's how we get to the efficacy. Yeah.
So a hydroethanolic extract, that's like an alcohol. You're like making basically a tincture and then you're drying it and then powderizing.
Wow. Yeah. Sometimes it'll be spray dried. So you just kind of like it, it just kind of like gets converted into a powder.
Huh.
Cool. Yeah. When you go to visit some of these manufacturing facilities where the magic happens, it's like the scale of it. And then the techniques that are being applied so that we can have access to these herbs in large quantities. It's really remarkable.
That is cool. Of course, as like my down home herbalist vibe, I'm like, are they like dunking the tea bags and tinctures or how do you do that?
Yeah. Well, I have to say our R&D team is so clever and innovative in terms of how we kind of come up with ways to deliver the efficacy, because oftentimes we are, you know, working with our partners to create custom extracts. It's not always the thing that is just already available. So we might have to work to really kind of create something that will diffuse easily into the tea bag. And quite honestly, sometimes we just don't get there. Not everything goes in a tea bag. And that's why we are very interested in other ways like of delivering herbs as well. We aren't just an herbal tea company. So, yeah.
I would like to talk a little bit about herbal fads while we have some time, because you've been in the supplement industry for a while, and there just seems to be every few years, there's a new herb that gets really big. Like right now it looks like ashwagandha, but there's like elderberry also is getting really big. But how do you see those fads? Cause it, in some ways it's helpful, you know, because everyone's knowing about elderberry now, but also kind of dilutes the knowledge sometimes and makes it like they get things wrong, I think.
Yeah, I mean, it's challenging when things all of a sudden become popular, and or can be, right? It can be. Yeah. TikTok, social media is really driving awareness in many ways of herbs or ingredients that people are really interested in for their wellness. And in many ways, that's wonderful. Sometimes, though, the claims of what these things do become quite
blown fantastic. Up.
Yeah. Yeah.
Overblown. Yeah.
Yeah. Which I'm not saying that's the case in elderberry. I think the beautiful thing about elderberry is that there's a ton of great science, and it's, you know, the things that are tried and true, they can deliver, like they can deliver on the promise, and therefore, you know, you don't necessarily see it kind of be like, oh, we liked this thing, but then it didn't actually do what we thought it was going to do, so we're going to abandon it, right? And that's what happens with a fad, is it's like, oh, nope, didn't help me lose 30 pounds after all. You know, that thing.
Well, yeah, sometimes the fads can, like, you'll have overblown expectations, and then you'll expect too much. Well, it doesn't deliver, but the things that it does do then are neglected, or mm-hmm. you know, then that's cast aside. The baby is thrown out with the bathwater.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is so true. It's you don't really have the full appreciation of the herb. In fact, what happens so often is that people tend to focus on just one component within the herb. Mm.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, oh, instead of talking, I mean, obviously with CBD, right? We like no one ever even said hemp. It was all CBD, which is right. which is like a component of the plant. Mm-hmm. And we see that. I think obviously that has been something that spiked a lot, and now not quite where it was. Significant drop in sales of CBD over the last 4 years in the claims, right? It did everything. So that's something that happens a lot.
So with, you know, big companies like TM and other companies that are, you know, getting all of these herbs out to the people and accessible so that somebody can go and get a throat coat from Walmart if mm-hmm. they have a sore throat and it's going to be helpful. Like with all that, you know, increase in accessibility, are you seeing that like the farmers and the growers are able to keep up? Are there things that you run out of or have a hard time sourcing? Like, are there enough herbs to go around?
You know, at times, so we were just talking about these influencers or, you know, things that come right. onto the radar through social media that actually creates a spike in our business, right? That can sometimes be disruptive. Again, it's always this like tension of like, wow, we're so excited that people all of a sudden want more lemon balm or raspberry leaf or nettle. Right. But we have to actually like give our partners very much like advance notice of how much to be buying, because they need to plant it or they need to go out and find it. Yeah. So it's actually, not always helpful when those things happen. Raspberry is actually a perfect example. Again, people have been talking about it on TikTok. And so more and more people want to use raspberry leaf. Well, almost all of our raspberry leaf is wild collected. And with that increase in demand, we've had to kind of expand our network of where we get raspberry leaf from. It's available. I mean, the thing is, herbs, we need to make sure that we're taking care of the people that I mentioned this earlier, that are, you know, stewarding the land, whether they're growing, cultivating, or going out and working with the land to respectfully wild harvest. If we do that, then there's very much the chance that, yes, we will have access to these herbs for hopefully generations and generations, for I hope forever, right?
Yeah.
There's also real issues like climate change and political issues that can affect availability of herbs. So we have to pay attention to all that too. and work with kind of, again, our growers and our suppliers to be flexible and nimble when necessary. And yeah, the other thing is that a lot of the people that do this work, the farmers and the wild collectors, they're aging out. So the average age of a farmer is 58, and the average age of a wild collector is around 63. And the younger generation actually wants to go into the cities, right, where they believe there's more opportunity. And so we are actually, you know, developing programs, again, that's why it's so important to pay that fair living wage and invest back into the community so that people want to stay and do this work. And then find kind of ways to keep the younger generation engaged, like make this interesting, make this something that they want to do. Because yeah, we kind of need that. We rely on these partnerships to make these herbs available. So I'm very optimistic based on the work that TM is doing. But I think as an industry, as a kind of herbal industry, that same kind of care and consciousness is really required. And so I hope that through the work that TM does and educating consumers, again, to really vote with their wallet in terms of the companies they want to support, that they encourage this same kind of responsibility. And the thing that I think is really impactful that consumers can feel good about is when they purchase products that are produced in this way, we often feel like, I think as human beings, like helpless in terms of what can we do to help, like the climate and what's happening to the earth and the people, like how, what role can we play? Well, when we purchase, you know, and we engage with plant products that have been produced or grown, sourced using kind of organic growing methods or sustainable wild harvesting, we're actually preserving biodiversity. We're having a part to play in this whole kind of circle of good. And so, yeah, not only is that kind of medicine coming to our bodies, but it's also kind of going out into the world. And I think that's a really beautiful thing.
Yeah, that's a really good point.
Yeah.
Yeah, we got to keep it alive. And yeah.
People need fair wages, you know?
Right. It's a
very important part to make sure that. And I think maybe that's probably why TM's been going on for 50 years, because like having those direct contacts with the actual wildcrafters and farmers is just very important. And reinvesting in them instead of it just being like a fad, like making a bunch of money and then ditching or whatever, you know, it's important. Yeah. And I think it makes it more medicinal too, when it's like actually fair for everybody.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, in the same way that it's like you have that relationship with your clients or, you know, the people that you work directly with, and there's like, yeah, that's part of the healing. That's part of the, I don't know, the healing that happens as part of the medicine. I think through relationships with the plants, with the people, it is part of, you know, that medicine, again, of being more connected to nature. So yeah, it becomes quite, like I said, impactful we think about, just to put it into perspective, every second, 50 cups of TMT are brewed.
What?
Oh, yeah.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
The scale is kind of staggering there.
Holy moly.
Right? So, I mean, I think as herbalists, you can feel really good about plants getting to more people, right? Absolutely. And we want to do more of that in the world.
Yeah.
We want to do more.
Yeah, because I think in the US, especially in the West, the herbalism has become in the last few generations, it's been derided. It's been like moved aside, pushed aside, and the culture hasn't accepted it so much. But I am personally interested in fostering a culture that is more connected with the earth and mm-hmm. with herbal medicine. And so I feel like there's got to be these ways for people who don't know nettle from yarrow to right. access
yeah.
good quality. So right. it's kind of like a pipeline into herbalism, a gateway. Yeah. yeah,
absolutely. That is 100% how we see it, is like, you might come to traditional medicinals because you have a sore throat. You know, you see throat coat is kind of one of the classics. It's yeah. one of our best sellers. But then we hope that through that experience of, well, this made my throat feel better, what else can herbs do for me?
Yeah.
That, yeah, you kind of go on a journey to learn more about plants, herbalism, and hopefully incorporate herbs into your daily routine. I mean, that's ultimately what, you know, more herbs and more people, right? Mm-hmm. That's
yeah.
me. That's how we build our resilience in the world. That's how we, you know, the plants and all of their adaptations that they've kind of created through their much longer history of living on the earth, that they kind of lend to us so generously. I feel like, yeah, it's such a gift, right? So the more that we can embrace that and that, you know, diversity of exposure to plant chemistries, the more I'd say ready we are to be our best in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You have a favorite TM product?
This is really hard, but I would say my go-to is the lemon balm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Definitely kind of. Which one?
I like throat coat, you know.
Throat coat is not necessarily just a seasonal item, you know. It's something that we have this whole campaign right now, that voices are for using, not losing. And so for people that actually talk a lot, like you all do here. And
I was a traveling musician for a number of years.
There you go.
It saved my voice a couple times.
Yeah.
That's amazing. Yeah. We have a partnership with Dave Matthews right now.
Oh,
yeah. We've been sponsoring his tour and giving out samples of throat coat. We have a booth set up at some of his events, and he's a big fan. So
yeah, cool. Sweet.
So yeah, it's a musician's friend, but it's, yeah, something that I think a lot of people find a lot of joy in just by experiencing it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Awesome. So anything that you're like looking forward to coming up through traditional medicinals or even in your own life, like what do you got going on?
Next? Well, I just found out yesterday that I'm going to be visiting Trout Lake Farm up in Washington, which is like our main supply partner for our peppermint. They literally grow like the best peppermint in the world. So yeah, we've been working with them since the 70s, actually. So they've been very much a part of our journey. And, you know, just they very much committed to organic, regenerative, sustainability, like very much sharing a lot of the same values as us. And their peppermint, I mean, that is, you know, you asked me what my favorite is. Lemon yeah. balm, peppermint, chamomile. Those are probably my top three heroes.
Together too.
Yeah, you can mix them all together very, very nicely.
Yeah.
And yeah, so like, just to give you an idea, like you were talking before about the peppermint and how, you know, that potency sometimes is even just like, wow, it's, you notice it with that peppermint, kind of the minimum quality, like marker for menthol, which is again, that kind of cooling chemistry in peppermint mm-hmm. that also delivers a lot of its efficacy. The minimum amount, according to the pharmacopoeia, is 0.9%. Okay. And in the peppermint that we get from Trout Lake Farm, it's much closer to like 2%. So it's like double the potency of, you know, the standard, even efficacious pharmacopeial grade herb. So it's really good stuff. And I'm looking forward to going up there. And there's something that happens too, when you're in like a giant field of the same herb, right? Where like,
yes.
you just really feel it. You feel, you know, it's personality coming through. And yeah, so I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, I wonder what the personality of Peppermint is gonna unfold in front of your eyes. Like, that's so interesting. We'll have to check in on that after you
We'll
go.
Check in. Yeah, that sounds good.
Sweet. Well, this has been amazing. The hour has flown by, Taryn. Thank you so much for taking the time to chat with us today.
It was a pleasure. It was a pleasure. Awesome. Thank you for having me. I enjoyed telling the stories.
Yes. Hey.